Let's see. Thanks, Keith. Our next speaker is Sasha Husa, who's coming to us from University.
So I thank everybody in the audience who's still here this time. So the title is Topology Change of Event Horizons and the Merger of Black Holes. And this is work done with Jeffrey Winnicore at the University of Pittsburgh. And it's heavily based on earlier work by Leonard Gomez, Bishop, Szilagyi, and Winnicore, where they basically developed the formalism that I'm going to use and studied the axisymmetric case, and now I'm interested in generalization to the generic case. Here you see a black hole, which is yellow and has two holes in it. And I show this picture because in some of the earlier talks this week we have heard remarks that that black holes or spatial slices of event horizons can have basically arbitrarily complicated topology because the topology at early times is slicing independent. So lots of weird things can happen. And what I'm going to talk about today is basically an explicit construction for the intrinsic geometry of an event horizon so that one can study these phenomena explicitly and make nice pictures and see the things, which is kind of nice. So that's sort of, it's a new approach to the event horizon because we don't locate it in a given space-time, but we construct the geometry of the event horizon directly. Okay. So the original motivation for this was to use data on the event horizon as part of the initial data in a double null evolution problem. Where the space-time is then obtained a posteriori. And the application I want to focus on here is to study these topology change phenomena in the event horizon. So the axisymmetric case, which was dealt with in this paper I mentioned before, and one of the things people did there was to reproduce the pair of pants picture that has been found previously in numerical simulations of axisymmetric head-on collisions of black holes, and which has also prominently made it to this famous picture on the cover of Science magazine. Also note that their event horizon is green, ours is yellow. Ours, of course, looks much nicer. And they also reproduce toroidal event horizons, which have previously been found in numerical simulations of the collapse of rotating matter, or dust in this case. But axisymmetry has some non-generic features, and the question I would like to answer is what happens in the generic case, and in particular in generic merger situations, which you have kind of two black holes. So how does a space-time picture look like? So like this, so you sort of initially you have two black holes, then they're sort of going to merge. You have square minus, you have square plus. And the way we can pose the initial data now is we pose initial data on the event horizon and on square plus, say, and then we use a double null evolution code to evolve backwards and calculate this region of space-time up to here. Why only up to here? Because with the present technology of characteristic evolution, we can only go up to the caustics. Now, in order to get a little more formal, I want to briefly remind you of what the event horizon of a black hole is. So basically that's the boundary of the causal path of square plus, and we know that it's generated by light rays, and it extends into the past until either a neighboring ray is caustic at the caustics at C, or a non-neighboring ray is intersect at the crossover set X. So basically, rays from outside the event horizon, they join the black hole at the union of these sets x and c. And in the future, the area of the event horizon reaches some finite asymptotic limit. One sort of conceptual inconvenience is that because of this, the event horizon is naturally calculated in a backwards in time fashion, because you follow it back basically from scry. So the direction of computation is opposite to the physical sense, physical time development of the space-time. And it's conceptually a little simpler to describe the horizon structure from the time reverse point of view of a white hole. So now the event horizon is the boundary of the future of scry minus. So basically, we just turn around like this, and now we have a fissioning white hole. So it has one component initially, and then it fissions into two components, which have finite lifetime here. And we give initial data on scry minus and on some portion of the event horizon, and we calculate into the future. For instance, we could put initial data here, which sort of correspond to no incoming radiation, and then here we would see what radiation comes out of the white hole fissioning. In some more sophisticated second step, one could look at the problem of what kind of radiation do I have to put in here that nothing comes out here, because then I have solved the other problem in sort of grand challenge in a time reverse way, because now nothing came in here, and what came out here is the radiation from the black hole merger. And Roberto is going to talk about this in an upcoming talk. But now the question is, how do we actually calculate the geometry of the event horizon? We are not going to do it in full generality, but we are going to do it for some wide, hopefully sufficiently wide class of geometries that give some intuition. And the model is essentially analytic. So how do we produce this essentially analytic model? Well, we start with some null hypersurface in flat Minkowski space, which is very simple. So how do we get this null surface in Minkowski space? We choose some convex two-dimensional surface, this blue thing here, and we follow the light rays which go out of it, which have sort of a boring history. But then we also follow the light rays which go inward, which do more exciting things because they cross over and caustic at this red surface here. And if they, so after they cross and caustic, they're not so interesting anymore. Because now what we do, we are going to construct the curved case from this. So how do we do this? First, we hit the intrinsic geometry with a conformal factor. And then we also have the freedom to change the affine structure of the null surface. So while this surface had some affine parameter t hat, now we introduce some new affine parameter t of t hat. Alright, so basically we have two structures on this null surface. We have the intrinsic metric and the affine structure. And the intrinsic metric we change by hitting it with a conformal factor. And for the affine structure, we make this answer here, which is sort of similar. And then if you require that Einstein's vacuum equations are actually satisfied, of course we get some equations which correspond to the focusing equation on the null surface. And now one can basically choose the conformal factor or choose the affine structure or whatever. What we do is we choose the conformal factor, and we choose it in a way that it basically becomes zero up here, so it makes the area finite into the future, which would otherwise become infinite. So that also the cross section of the horizon becomes a marginal trapped surface into the asymptotic future. And then we get some equation for this function lambda here, which can be solved exactly. And if we know lambda, we get some ordinary differential equation which relates the two affine parameters along each ray. Okay? So that's what we have to solve for. In general, one has to solve for this numerically, but note that the solution of this ODE is only necessary if I want to know the actual slicing-dependent features. If I want to answer questions which can be answered in terms of each ray, then we don't need it. For instance, this would be questions like, does the crossover happen before or after something else happens? This is slicing independent, and we can answer it in terms of the completely analytic model. Okay. And note also in particular, of course, now that we have this different slicing, it will hit the, it will cut out a different topology, slicing with different topology out of this crossover and caustic surface. And that's basically the reason, the mechanism for the topology change. So I skip all the technical details. Some further points. So how basically, what do we choose? What is the input that we choose? Well, first of all, we choose this convex two-surface. For instance, in the axisymmetric case, we could choose it to be a spheroid, or in the generic case, without continuous symmetries, we choose it to be an ellipsoid, which has just discrete symmetries that one can get over with by some intuition. So there's no restriction to generality. And then we choose the conformal factor in such a way that it guarantees regularity and satisfies some boundary conditions, like this marginal trapped surface condition that we have, which basically makes this null surface the horizon. So now if you want to get a generic picture of what happens, especially at this early stage here, what we could typically expect how slices look like, why do we have to go to full 3D to get results? Well, first, if you would study spherical symmetry, then catastrophe theory would tell us that the caustics are unstable, so that's no good. The next simplest, or next case would be prolate axisymmetric collapse. For instance, if we choose this initial convex surface to be a prolate spheroid, so basically this would correspond to the head-on collision of two black holes in axisymmetry. Here we form cusps and folds, which are stable, but the problem is that the seam of the pair of pens, sorry, show this nice picture again. So this seam of the pens in the axisymmetric case is just a line, but generically the crossover surface is to be two-dimensional, because if I shoot two null surfaces to each other, the intersection will be generically two-dimensional. So this cannot be the generic case. Let's look at some pictures. So Luis has provided me with this nice picture of the pair of pens upside down in the white hole perspective for a prolate fission. So we see that this seam here, which is just one-dimensional, so which cannot be generic. But note that this picture, of course, has one dimension suppressed. So actually, just from the picture, we cannot tell, for instance, if a slice up here would correspond to two individual spherical things or to a torus, because we can't complete the other dimension like this or the other way like this. So there are two interpretations. One is the prolate case, where the time evolution would look like this. So we start with some spheroid, which is sort of prolate, and then as we follow the white hole into the future or the black hole into the past, it becomes more prolate. It gets thin in the middle, and then at this time it has already fissioned, and this blue kind of surface here marks those points which have already left the black hole horizon, or the white hole in this case. And what is left is these two teardrop-like components which have a sharp tip where they have the caustic. Now, so this was the prolate case. How does the oblate case look like? Well, in the oblate case, we have a picture like this. We start with an oblate spheroid, and the poles basically are going to cross over first. So we have this golden surface, which is the actual event horizon. And the blue surface are those points which are on this null surface, but which have actually crossed over. So they're not on the event horizon anymore. So what we're left with is some toroidal topology of the event horizon at this early time, or late time for the black hole. And now the event horizon, this toroidal event horizon, because it's axisymmetric, it shrinks to zero until it's a circle and the hole vanishes. Okay? So, and this is exactly the kind of picture that would correspond to these rotating dust collapse, which have been just been found by Shapiro and Tukosky. Now, the question is, what happens in the generic case? So what happens in the generic case? What you would expect is that it's very simple. Because it's not axisymmetric anymore, some of these circles shrink faster than other circles. So that one circle shrinks faster, and that's where the torus breaks apart, and we have spherical topology again. If we, then maybe some second circle is the second fastest, and the thing breaks in two components, and that, for instance, would correspond to some generic black hole merger situation. So let's see if this is actually the case. Let's look at some pictures for the generic case. So we start with some generic ellipsoid, a kind of a boring transparency. And so this is now some slice, some sort of late slice through the black, through the white hole, soon before anything interesting is going to happen. Now, at a little later time, the white hole has bulged inwards, so we can see that very soon probably you're going to develop a hole in the middle. And indeed, a little later, it looks like this. So we already have a hole in the middle. We have toroidal topology, and some circles are much thinner than others, so these are going to tear apart first. So a little later, it looks like this. So we have two components of the white hole, and they have these sharp pincers, and in between them there is a sharp line, which is the cross-section of the crossover surface. So it's a one-dimensional slice of the crossover surface. And this will continue the time evolution. What's going to happen if we just move apart and shrink to zero after some time? Okay. So, of course, choosing the initial convex surface and choosing the ellipsoid and choosing the conformal factor, one has a very big degree of freedom. The question is, what happens generically if one walks around in this very big configuration space? And what we have found is that all the configurations which can be interpreted as a black hole merger, where the lifetime of the individual, where after some time two individual components develop, and their lifetime is very long compared, for instance, to the lifetime of the non-trivial topology, which one could interpret as a merger case, it's always the case that you have one hole in the middle. So you have spherical topology, then you go through a toroidal phase, and then the whole thing rips apart, and after a while it looks like this. But one can also arrange for many, many other cases, for instance, like the one I showed before, where the thing has two holes or more holes, or arbitrarily complicated topology. So, some conclusions. The first thing to mention is that these models are hoped to serve as a guide to explore new physical situations. In particular, by setting up the initial data, so one can sort of look what looks like interesting initial data and then see what they give as one evolves them. On the other hand, because the whole thing is essentially analytic, and actually some of the solutions that we have produced are exactly solvable, and the whole geometry, also the slicing, is exactly known. They can also be used to serve as some a posteriori tool to understand, for instance, what happened in some 3D generic simulation. For instance, as it happened with the axisymmetric case, where people found this pair of fence structure, but then the analytic construction sort of reveals some better understanding of what is actually going on, and what the structure of the caustics and crossover really is. So then, of course, so young black holes generically, which means not necessarily, but a generic class, goes through some toroidal phase, so that this toroidal event horizon, which was found for the axisymmetric rotating cluster, is not some oddity, but is some generic situation. And also, there's absolutely no problem for topological censorship because the crossover surface is space-like. So what happens is just in some suitable slicing, the event horizon basically would end at some certain time, which is aligned with the crossover surface. But then if I perturb it slightly with some other slicing, I can get arbitrarily complicated topology, of course. But that's no problem for topological censorship. Then this toroidal phase provides some generic mechanism of how one can imagine the event horizon changes from two components to one component, which is geometrically generic and is stable under perturbations. And as I said before, of course, one can also construct much more complicated topology. But what we would expect is if you take some basically arbitrary slicing, some reasonable slicing, and some 3D evolution of a two black hole merger code, then the shape of the event horizon, if one locates it afterwards, would probably look like the one I've shown, where you have one torus at some stage, and then the thing rips apart. So now I'm done with the talk, but I have a little video that I can also show, which shows everything in motion. So maybe you start it. And it has narration, so I can relax now. I have to excuse that the narration is basically for a non-relativist audience. It's more advertisement. That's not part of that.
Corresponds to an initially toroidal black hole. The light blue region shows light rays that have intersected and left the event horizon. This animation shows a generic case. Its oblique is becoming clear with time. It looks axisymmetric, but it's not. And for a while, it shows the history of the previous case. The rays at the poles of the event horizon cross first, and the event horizon becomes a torus, losing points at an inner edge. As time goes by, the deviation from axial symmetry becomes evident. Previously, the event horizon ended as a circle, but here it splits like a building torn apart. This animation shows a model which falls somewhere between the preceding two cases. It starts out very much like the axisymmetric case, but some of the features seen in the non-symmetric case appear. A hole forms in the middle, and after a while, the toroidal white hole is ripped into two pieces. The first caustic appears as the horizon is torn apart, so at this moment, the first dark blue appears. We pause at the moment the central crossing begins to form to show a cutaway view. After this moment, the event horizon becomes a torus. The animation resumes as the event horizon elongates. We pause the information again at the moment the horizon splits in two, showing the formation of pincers between the sections. Thus, we see that the event horizon of two merging black holes generically goes through a toroidal phase before it becomes spherical.
Alright, so how does one turn it off?
Okay, let's thank our speaker. Questions for Sasha?
I have a couple of questions. First of all, as you pointed out in the very beginning of your talk, this business about whether it's toroidal or not is complete slicing dependent phenomena, right? I mean, it's not
and then also you said,
I could just take in the generic case, the slicing, in which I don't see any torus at all.
Well, but yeah, you could produce any topology, but
it's interesting anyway, but my question is really then, I mean, all the emphasis was on the torus, but so if I don't want to think about it as, you know, slicing dependent phenomena, what is the difference in the generic case and the axisymmetric case? What is the covariant difference in the...
The dimensionality of the crossover set.
In the generic case, it's two-dimensional, and the axisymmetric case, it's only one.
And then, of course, one can ask the question, what would happen in a slicing one expects to be sort of reasonable, not contrived?
Okay.
Because a slicing that would show, when you have the physical situation of two black holes colliding, you could produce a slicing where you have seven components at some time, but of course it would be very contrived. So the question is, because we choose as the slicing the affine structure, that some... So we believe that that's some reasonable slicing which gives a good picture of what actually happens.
My second question was that you didn't refer to sort of solving any equations, but you are solving some Einstein's equations intrinsic to the surface, isn't that right?
Basically the Hamiltonian constraint.
Yeah, the Reichelder equation basically. So that was a constraint on what? That was a constraint on lambda, or was that a constraint on omega, or what?
Well, I mean, in a sense, this is your choice because both quantities are involved. But the way we set it up here was that we just chose the conformal factor and we take it as an equation for lambda. Yeah.
White holes are usually believed to be unstable and to evolve fairly quickly to black holes. So how do you evolve white holes for long times and keep them as white holes?
Well, I think, long, that depends very much on your physical situation. What exactly happens in the time evolution. For this question, you would really have to consider the whole space-time, of course. And this would also depend on what initial conditions you set on the other null surface, what radiation you send in or whatever you do there. So But just by looking at the intrinsic geometry of the horizon, you cannot answer this question. I mean, it's just not related. But maybe, Robert, you want to comment on this? Oh, Roberto is going to talk about it, yes.
Then you tell us also what happens at the intersection, do you?
I will not get there.
No, well, of course, the maximal extension of this technique with the ordinary characteristic method can be up to the place where it splits and where the caustics appear, because we
I'm talking about the intersection which you have drawn in the picture of Scry and the horizon. I mean, what do you assume there?
Well, there are several quantities there that need to be adjusted. So we embed these three surfaces, which would be the horizon, in the fourth spacetime by assigning some extrinsic curvature. So and that is related to what Sean Hayward talked the other day. So we are basically putting field values there that satisfy continuity conditions on the intersection. That's the only thing we're given there. But it's since this is going to be a double null problem, it's much simpler to put conditions on that problem than if the surface were time-like, because whatever thing we put on the null surface on Scry minus won't get to the white hole horizon.
Is this really the situation you have short surface?
I don't understand the question very well.
But of course, for practical purposes, practical purposes, one does not really have to go to Scry, but one can set up the whole thing where the slice of the horizon is basically almost spherical, and that's the time at which the two null surfaces meet.
Okay, then
you do that. Yeah, we don't go all the way to Scry minus. But that's the picture we want to have in. Right. But we want to keep the picture of Scry minus so that, in a way, we can give some boundary, some initial data that would represent very little radiation coming in. But that's a huge problem, and we're working on that.
I just wanted to mention some work by colleagues of mine in Kyoto, which is very much along these lines. Masaru Shino has done some analytical work on the topology of the event horizon, which very much agrees with what you've done. He also showed that the toroidal case is the generic one, but by stability analysis. And he showed that the caustic set is space-like. And he discussed the topology, the way that you can look at the boundaries of the caustic set and classify that all. Because it's space-like, you can, of course, embed it in a space-like hypersurface. Yeah. So if you took that choice of slicing, then the topology change is always trivial.
Yeah.
It goes immediately.
We know the papers. But my impression was that in these papers, the application to the case where you have two or more components of the horizon which are going to merge was not completely worked out.
And also, one could use the size of this caustic set as a measure of the size of the black hole. And we studied an analytic solution for colliding black holes given by the Kasatrashian solution, and used the length of the seam in that case as a measure of the circumference needed for the Hoop conjecture. And it turned out the Hoop conjecture was satisfied for those solutions. Well, this is
surprising. Maybe then I should also mention that for the axisymmetric case, in the first paper they have also looked at the Hoop conjecture for the event horizon, and they were able to significantly violate it. But the significance is probably very diffuse. So.